Turn that guitar up.
Welcome to In the Studio, a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock albums. I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, one of the most popular bands ever survives its greatest existential threat, even while experiencing a momentary lapse of reason.
Lurching into the future, bearing the mantle of Pink Floyd without Roger in 1987 was a tough one. As anyone can imagine, it's a big, tough mantle to stick on my poor shoulders and trudge forward into the future with.
I don't know if I've ever heard you verbalize it that way.
Well, it is. It's tough. And you're right to say that I was confident at the end and happy. Anyone would be happy and confident at the end when our moving forward and doing what we did, making the album, doing that tour, was justified.
Hello, this is David Gilmour of Pink Floyd.
And I'm Nick Mason of Pink Floyd. And we're in the studio.
Thankfully, it seems that time, maturity, other creative outlets, and mutual loss of old friends and colleagues have brought the warring factions of Pink Floyd to a truce. But in early 1987, it was becoming painfully apparent that there was a yawning hole in the overall rock world that had previously and uniquely been occupied by Pink Floyd. 20 years earlier, in a band formed by Syd Barrett and Roger Waters with drummer Nick Mason and keyboard player Rick Wright, the first Pink Floyd album had set them on a road of experimentation, exploration, and innovation with heady atmospheric musical arrangements and thoughtful lyrical themes. But Syd Barrett became mentally incapacitated after only one album with Pink Floyd, and David Gilmour joined for what would be some of rock's greatest landmark albums, including The Dark Side of the Moon, Wish You Were Here, The Underrated Animals, and the epic album, tour, and movie, The Wall. As is so often the case, the creative sparks that ignited such music were caused by friction within Pink Floyd, and for the five-year period between 1982 and 1987, Pink Floyd was MIA. For instance, Pink Floyd was conspicuously absent at the largest one-day gathering of rock royalty, 1985's Live Aid concerts in London and Philadelphia. The estrangement that Roger Waters had with the other three members of Pink Floyd after the 1982 album The Final Cut went all the way back to the Wall movie, according to Pink Floyd singer, songwriter, guitarist David Gilmour.
The arguments and fights that myself and Roger had during the latter half of making the album were pretty intense on certain things. We had some real major scraps on certain things, and that left our relationship a bit more damaged at the end of that album. And again, in the film, there were one or two things that happened during the film that I felt that I absolutely had to do, that I know Roger's never forgiven me for. on outvoting him and telling him that he had to stay in line on certain things, which are very sort of hard to explain, but when you've got millions of dollars invested in a project, there are certain protections that you have to stick to, that I felt I had to stick to. And so I was the only one around who could actually take on the role of overruling him and telling him that there were certain things that he couldn't do. And I think that's sort of that period, our relationship probably became irreparably damaged and remained that way through the Final Cut album, which was torture. And, well, that leaves us where we are now, which is fine.
To be disowned.
From September 1987's A Momentary Lapse of Reason, that's Pink Floyd with The Dogs of War. Pink Floyd drummer Nick Mason remembers the low point at which Pink Floyd's future dangled precariously.
I suppose for me, probably the making of the final cut was the most difficult. I think by then there was very much a feeling that we were really hardly a band anymore, that the sum was no longer greater than the parts, that we weren't achieving anything like our potential. But the thing became, I think it became a sort of an arena for all the problems of Roger feeling that really he wanted to either leave the band or run it his way. And the material became, it sort of drifted actually. I think it probably drifted away from one idea and then became a sort of new concept and a new story. That happened halfway through, and instead of perhaps ditching it, which is perhaps what we should have done, or rethinking it, we didn't even really have the sort of mechanism set up anymore as a band to be able to sort of sit and talk rationally about it. It would have simply been another opportunity for a fight. I suppose I saw that album as the beginning of the end.
In February 1984, David Gilmour released his second solo album called About Face and even toured with an all-star band of Brits, including Mick Ralph from Bad Company and drummer Chris Slade, later to join AC/DC. But it wasn't until the very end of 1985 that Roger Waters' official departure from Pink Floyd was revealed to the other band members. And this bowling ball move left Pink Floyd with the equivalent of the dreaded 7-10 split. Waters' position set off legal proceedings. At the beginning of the Momentary Lapse of Reason tour in November 1987, here's what David Gilmour told me in the studio.
We hadn't been served any actual writs or anything. Nothing had been actually done in a court against us. There were papers served against us, which are for a two or three court issues, but nothing like an injunction or anything, or an attachment or anything that can actually prevent you from doing anything, had been even attempted. Of course, I am in possession of all sorts of things which other people aren't in possession of. I'm in possession of copies of letters that Roger sent to the record company saying that I have left Pink Floyd, and they're quite clear and categoric and precise. And they were in December 1985, so no press statement or anything has been issued ever by us saying that we have split up temporarily or otherwise. You know, there have been a lot of stories about us breaking up at various points. People saying, well, I'm glad you got back together. We've never split up. There's never been anything issued like that. And it's been a lot of assumption and pushing by Roger. I just blithely carry on in my own way, you know, and my career is not going to be taken away from me. You can believe me.
In February 1987, backstage at London's Wembley Arena, I spotted David Gilmour, so I asked him what he was doing musically. Imagine my delight when he answered that he was engrossed in a new Pink Floyd album. We talked by phone the very next day.
During the period of our sort of disintegration with Roger and Roger's leaving, I was consistent, I would think, in saying that I intended to carry on and do it again. Whatever happened, with or without Roger, the intention was always to have a go at it. And at some point in 86, I started sort of gathering demos together and seeing what we could get. And Nick came down and Bob Ezrin came over, and we started working away in the studio in, I think, the beginning of October of 86, to the end of seeing whether we thought we could put a Pink Floyd record together. There was a time there when we hadn't actually said to anyone else or anyone that that's what we were doing, and there was always the possibility of demoting it to a third solo album for me, if you like, if it didn't start really coming together. But the intention was to make it a Pink Floyd record, and it took a while, took really till past that Christmas before we were really certain into the beginning of 87 before we were convinced that that's what we were going to do, and we were happy with what was going on.
After the legal saber-rattling failed to stop Pink Floyd, Roger Waters turned his attention to the court of public opinion, enlisting several respected rock critics to advocate that A Momentary Lapse of Reason was a rejected third David Gilmour solo album, masquerading as Pink Floyd. Even now, writer William Ruhlman in the AllMusic Guide dismisses Momentary Lapse with a sardonic single-sentence review. David Gilmour reacts.
No, it's a fantasy. You're right. I was working away mostly on my own in my home studio, trying to put demos down till I felt confident enough about starting a record. And when we actually started together in October of that year with Ezrin and Nick and myself down working away in a studio, we put together a bunch of these things. And, yeah, you know, a lot of stuff isn't so good and stuff, some stuff is good. But we carried on working with it. And by about Christmas, we thought we were on the right track. But at no point previous to that had we ever scrapped any sort of album or any concept or anything like that. Yeah, there were one or two tracks, certainly, that we thought, no, that one's not going to really make it, and we would put it to one side. But no, it was just a gradually moving forward thing. Restless eye across the wind. On the road to ruin. The music played as we whirled without end. No hint, no word, how am I to defend? I will, she sighed to my request. Then she tossed her mane, all my resolve was put to the test. Then drowned in desire, my soul's on fire, I led the way to the funeral pyre. Without a thought, the consequence, I gave in to my decadence. One step.
You'll find out that the album was inspired both on the water and high above the clouds. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with David Gilmour and Nick Mason of A Momentary Lapse of Reason.
Welcome back in the studio with Redbeard. This is David Gilmour of Pink Floyd.
Welcome back in the studio. I'm Nick Mason of Pink Floyd with Redbeard.
Thank you, gents. When talking to David Gilmour while actually in the studio making A Momentary Lapse of Reason in February 1987, Gilmour revealed that much of the album was uniquely recorded at his home at Garrick Lawn.
Mostly on the houseboat, my studio in London. It's called Astoria, which we did quite a bit of the last album on as well.
A floating recording studio. Why a houseboat? What?
There's no real reason. It was an accident. I spotted this place. I saw it when it came up for sale. And I didn't really have a plan for it. I didn't even think about it as a recording studio at the time. It wasn't expensive, and it was a very beautiful little thing. So,
what body of water is it on?
It's on the Thames River in near London.
It must be very picturesque. Nice place to go to work and spend.
It's beautiful, yes. It's an unusual recording studio. It's covered in windows everywhere, and all you can see are ducks and geese and swans and stuff swimming around outside.
Of this.
David Gilmour, it seems, had become an avid pilot, and when he wasn't writing with lyricist Anthony Moore, you might spot Gilmour flying high above Kent over the English countryside.
Well, Anthony Moore, a friend of mine who wrote some of the stuff on the album, some of the lyrics, was working away at the boat on the studio, and whenever there was a nice day, I would disappear off to the airfield and have a flying lessons, and this rather frustrated him, I think. And he would, one day, while I was away flying, and he was in a bout of frustration and rage at me not being there, he obviously started writing a song about learning to fly. Damn good little tune, if you ask me. I made a demo of the music for that, quite a nice sounding demo. And Anthony came in one day when I was just playing this thing, and he instantly loved it and instantly wanted to take a copy away with him, and came back like the next day with the first draft of the lyrics for that. And it was one of those instant ones where he demanded that I let him have it and that he write the lyrics for it, because it obviously, musically, was a track that sparked him off instantly. And it's really what it's all about when things like that happen, when you write something that sparks someone else off in a major way to go and be creative with what you've done.
On the turning away from the pale and downtrodden and the words they say which we won't understand, don't accept that what's happening is just a case of all the suffering, or you'll find that you're joining in the turning away. It's a sin that somehow light is changing to shadow and casting its shroud over all we have known. Oh, the world, how the ranks have grown, driven on by a heart of stone. We could find that we're all alone in the dream of the ground on the wing.
On the Turning Away reminds me of an old English church hymn. With music by David Gilmour and lyrics by Anthony Moore, it appears on Pink Floyd's A Momentary Lapse of Reason. Next, Pink Floyd shatters concert records, but David Gilmour reveals at what personal price. And Nick Mason explains how success can make you an even bigger target for criticism. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with David Gilmour and Nick Mason, A Momentary Lapse of Reason.
Welcome back in the studio with Redbeard. This is David Gilmour of Pink Floyd.
Welcome back in the studio. I'm Nick Mason of Pink Floyd with Redbeard.
Thanks again, guys. By the end of the long Momentary Lapse 1987-88 Pink Floyd tour, many of the questions surrounding the band had been answered. First, the threatened legal action by departed band member Roger Waters didn't have enough merit. You see, there are no prenuptial agreements in rock bands. Second, over 5 million copies of A Momentary Lapse of Reason were sold, and the Pink Floyd tour had gone from multiple nights in arenas to multiple nights in stadiums, breaking the $1 million per night barrier, something unimaginable only 10 years earlier in concerts. Pink Floyd played to more than 10 million fans in 15 different countries. When I congratulated David Gilmour on their success, he appeared confident and self-satisfied.
Too self-satisfied, maybe.
Well,
maybe too self-satisfied.
Why do you say that? Isn't success the best revenge?
Yes. I mean, I don't know how interested I am in revenge. It's, you know, it's a long, painful process, which was trying to deprive me of my liberty to do what I wanted to do. And I don't really react terribly well to that. Lurching into the future, bearing the mantle of Pink Floyd without Roger in 1987 was a tough one. It's as anyone can imagine, it's a big, tough mantle to stick on my poor shoulders and trudge forward into the future with.
I don't know if I've ever heard you verbalize it that way.
Well, it is. It's tough. And you're right to say that I was confident at the end and happy. Anyone would be happy and confident at the end when our moving forward and doing what we did, making the album, doing that tour, was justified. One can consider the merits of everyone's case in these things, but I don't think there's many people that wouldn't have thought at that point that we had every right to continue doing what we were doing.
What kind of person returned home after the extended Momentary Lapse world tour and its dizzying success?
Well, a sort of a schizophrenic person, I think, is the person that returned from all that. I was very happy with our success, very happy with what we had achieved professionally during that time. But I was going through a very, very bad stage in my personal life, which wound up in a divorce and all that sort of stuff that one goes through. So it was, like I said, it was very schizophrenic. I was sort of very happy professionally, very unhappy personally. And so I was kind of messed up, I think, at the end of it all. I suppose really the first album that I was in charge of was the Momentary Lapse of Reason album, when I was sort of entering a really difficult personal phase, but didn't want to get into it and didn't want that to get into the record particularly, I guess. I don't really know. Right now, I'm in a much better personal state than I was at that time. Very happy in my life and not unhappy to sort of let it seep through into some of the music. You have to do what you feel is the right thing to do at any one given moment, and if you may not have the reasons for it firm up against the front of your mind, but these felt like the things that I wanted to put into the music, and some of them just come about accidentally, you know. And you start off with a little piece of music and something comes to mind and you think, yeah, and you start exploring it, and it takes its own volition. And the only decision you really have to make is whether you are brave enough to actually leave it there like that.
One cell, one single cell. One kiss, one single kiss. The face outside the window pane. However did it come to this?
fought and he has died. It's just the same as all the rest. He's not the worst and he's not the best.
Floyd's A Momentary Lapse of Reason, released in September 1987, Nick Mason fondly recalls the record-breaking tour.
I think the most important thing to say from my point of view about the Momentary Lapse tour was I had a wonderful time. The thing that we got from that was to go out and work long and hard enough to actually develop something to the point where you could say, it's right. All the touring we ever did through all the 70s and 80s, we never ever did enough. So the shows were always half developed. We could never put, with the exception of The Wall, where because it was to be filmed, we were able really to throw everything at it and do it properly. But we still never played it as well as we would have done if we'd done it for, let's say, at least 3 months.
Any sense of permanently quieting any detractors who questioned the authenticity of a Pink Floyd project like Momentary Lapse?
Success doesn't actually alleviate, it doesn't alleviate criticism. Unfortunately, there is no direct, that would be a wonderful thing if criticism was cancelled out by success. Unfortunately, that is not the case. I think, however successful you are, however long you've been doing it, most performers actually can be cut to the quick by criticism and can quite often, I think critics sometimes underestimate how hurtful and how easily they can actually cut through. The reason we're all up there is this desperate desire to show off and please people and perform. And so consequently, the one that does get away is the one that sort of gets through to your conscience and or to your psyche or whatever, not conscience really, but is the one that is disturbs you because you are always yourself a little uneasy about it, about whether you've really got it
uncertain,
right.
Uncertain, yeah.
And if I was writing critique on the band, there are always things that I'd pick up on and things that that aren't quite right or that perhaps philosophically are wrong. I mean, we inhabit a rather curious sort of area of rock music where what we do is sort of slightly off, you know, it's slightly off the beaten track in a way, which in some ways is terrific and in other ways is sort of curious. And I think for some people who, you know, there are always people who are going to find what we do a sort of, I suppose you could almost say, unnatural, and it will never work for them because it in some ways goes against the rules of rock and roll about how real rock music should be, which may be it should be in a bar somewhere, or it should be where you can see the sweat on everyone, or you have personalities, or whatever.
But I thought it was about also breaking rules.
Yes, but I mean, there are all sorts of rules, aren't there, that some are spoken, some are unspoken, and some are complete nonsense, but that we all sort of we allow to sort of roll along.
That's
I mean, we
allow it.
There will always be people who feel that Pink Floyd finished when Roger left, just as there are people who feel Pink Floyd ended when Syd Barrett left. And you can't change that for them. That is the case. And much as I would love to be able to sort of convince them otherwise, I understand. There's also a sort of concept that bands have to be. People would like to believe that they are made up of a sort of groups of lovable mop tops. It's the sort of the Beatles as they were in 1967. That's really our sort of ideal view of a band. And of course, it's not true. This goes back to the elements that make up a band. Generally, there's an enormous amount of conflict and tension in a band. It's considered, when it's reported, it's considered to be a scandal almost. But it's something that is allowed to drift on as a sort of concept of how rock music should be. But of course, it's complete nonsense. It's really easy to look back and really hard to look forward in terms of any sort of understanding of what we're up to. I mean, we were all absolutely brought up to believe that rock music was some ephemeral activity that would last for a year or 2 years or a few years, and then one would get on and do something else, get a proper job. And of course, it's not like that, but you have no idea. There is absolutely no guarantee that people will continue to buy the records or like the records, that you can suddenly be out of step with what people are interested in, what they want to hear. It could happen tomorrow. So you have no sort of real game plan for to how the future will go. But at that time, certainly, I just thought, I can't really see how we can make the next record, or if we can, it's a long time in the future, and it'll probably be more for just because of feeling of some obligation that we ought to do it rather than for an enthusiasm.
I'm coming to the theory that the tension may have actually extended the half-life of Pink Floyd twice as long as it would have if you were wrapped up after the wall and called it a career.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the dynamics of how bands work is still one of life's great mysteries. But it is very much part of a band's life. It's an interesting area to which conclusions can be drawn, but probably by people outside rather than inside.
I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests David Gilmour and Nick Mason of Pink Floyd. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard. For Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2017. All rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brune. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.